There was an interesting fellow named John Templeton, and he had a lot of money, and he felt that the advances in religion were more important than advances in science. So he established the Templeton Foundation, which gives an award for advances in religion. A couple of years ago, the recipient was Mother Teresa. In May of this year, Buckingham Palace, Dame Janet Vaughan received this prize. It's bigger than the Nobel Prize. It's $220,000. And this then serves to introduce to you one of the most remarkable I've ever met. A lady who has, in a sentence, rewritten the deathbed scene for our world today. And that is no small matter. How did this come about? I'll take you back to an interesting day this last April. I was asked to give the noon forum at the Cosmos Club in Washington. Ray Miller arranged for this. I had known Ray Miller a long time. And after my presentation on how animals help people, in which I showed scenes from St. Christopher's in London, he came running up afterwards as soon as the people left. As best you can run when you have Parkinson's. And he said, I didn't know you knew Cicely Saunders. She's been a house guest at my home for many years. And you know, it was in the 40s that I was visiting my friend Gordon Saunders in London. And while we were visiting, a very beautiful young nurse came running in, plopped down on her father's lap, and said, you must help me become a surgeon so that I can minister to the dying. And this was Dame Cicely Saunders, who during the war was at Oxford in politics, economics, and philosophy, and cut that education short so that she could become a nurse in the war. She hurt her back, so she went back to Oxford and became a medical social worker. But she realized that she needed something more, and that's why I related this event observed by Ray Miller. And she had been working at St. Luke's, and one day she befriended a Polish displaced person whose name was David Tasma. He was dying from cancer at the age of about 40. They had many conversations about dying and how this should really be done and the best situation for it. And out of this friendship, he set aside £500 for her to be a window in your home, because she had shared with him her dream, and she had gotten a lot of good feedback from him. And he also said that whatever you want that's in your mind and in your heart. And if you go into St. Christopher's today, you see the plaque for David Tasma with these statements on it. And now I'm going to tell you what I observed when I and Lady Wright visited there. She was, Dame Cicely was supposed to take us through a year ago last January when I visited. I've been corresponding with her for several years because she used animals in therapy. There are resident animals, and they also allow the visitors to be brought in, something I'll discuss, we'll discuss with you at 7 o'clock. So that's how I started the conversation. And she's done me one better, because one day she arranged for an elephant to come up to the hospital. But he was very tired, so she didn't take him in. Now, what is involved in this hospital that has become a model, I suppose, throughout the world for hospices, at least for some people? After she finished her medical training, which took another 7 or more years, she had been at St. Luke's. She went to St. Joseph's, which has been a hospice in London since 1908. And there is where she made her plans. She, on a fellowship, she went to Yale in 1966. They started St. Christopher's in 1967. St. Christopher's, for those of you who are not familiar with saints, except your mother, one of the auxiliary saints is Saint Christopher. He was a giant of a person in the second or third century. The theologians can correct me. And he spent his days and probably his nights carrying pilgrims across the river. And one day, and he's bent over on their monograph. He's bent over with a load, and it's a small child. And it's the Christ child, because that's what Christopher means. It's the Christ child, and the load is so heavy because he has the burden of the world. So that's why they call it St. Christopher's. Now, what did I find at St. Christopher's that might be worth considering for the committee here that is now writing a proposal for the farm? And the first thing, of course, is their handling of the patient relative to the pain. They have to get rid of the physical pain first, and you saw that in the last movie. They have the Brompton cocktail, but it's a better cocktail than the one that they use in this country. I won't go into the ingredients unless you press me. The first thing you notice is the space. She took literally when David Tasma said the window, and you'll see in the picture at 7 o'clock, the windows are clear down so you can see out and see what's going out around you. And the patients are in four in a room, and the curtains usually aren't pulled until death. They want that community in the open space. You're allowed, they encourage their staff to bring their children there. And they have a playground for children, so the faculty, the staff, or the patients can also see them playing. They also have facilities for old people there, the very frail old to live there, especially those who are relatives of the staff who work there. The other thing that I noticed, and it wasn't new to me, for I had served on the Board of Governors for Human Ecology, for the Institute of Human Ecology, which runs the Lutheran Hospital in Chicago, where everybody is on the healing team. At St. Christopher's, everybody is on the healing team. The person that delivers the paper and the one they had there then knew all the patients by name, the scrub woman, the hairdresser, the nurses, everybody's on the healing team. And they of course operate with a lot of volunteers. There are two people who work together so that they can change the sheets or whatever it is in the bed of the patient. The furniture is more homey than you see in a regular hospital, intentionally. The beds are quite low slung, and they're about as mobile as a wheelchair. And so they can move them around readily. They also have a canvas sling that you can settle back in that's very comfortable. And every patient is allotted five pillows, because they're very important to shore you up. I like that. They have a visiting from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., although I guess you can get in other times, except on Monday. Monday is a special day of celebration. Of course, much of it is celebration. But on Monday, it's kind of a special day. They have a drama and a lot of things going on, and it's when you get all gussied up. You get your hair curled and all fixed up. So Monday is a very special day there. I mentioned the relief of pain, and they don't go into any heroic measures, of course. I think the average stay is only about 12 days there. And sometimes, of course, the people go home. They have a ministry to the home. They operate also out of home. They have 74 beds there for people there, the terminally ill, but they have probably an equal or a greater number outside that they deal with teams. They have outpatient clinics, the daycare center, and most of the money that she got from the Temple Award is gone to a day center, so the people can come in and be brought in for the day. The rest is to plan a meeting next year, and I hope we can have a representative at it. As far as special procedures, the emphasis on procedures is not on heroic measures. You don't see, I didn't see any feeding tubes, no respirators. They use syringes very little. Wherever possible, they give it by mouth. The emphasis on back rubs, pleasant baths, favorite foods, and good mouth care. And at a time in your life when you don't have much choice, they give you a choice of what you want to eat. And if you used to smoke a cigar after dinner every night,
you smoke a cigar there. If you have two highballs after supper, you keep having two highballs after supper. They don't kind of change that routine. And the regimen for handling each one is pretty much tailor-made. And the health care specialists, they realize the need to sit down and talk it over. They emphasize gentle openness with no deceit. And they use honey, which is kind of interesting, to wipe out any unpleasant taste. And that isn't to say they don't resort to surgery in some cases. And I think that's all I want to say, because I want more time for Marie to discuss this, and we'll maybe close with something that Dame Cicely said. You'll find out where she's coming from as we close this thing tonight. I guess if I were to choose a verse that might describe it is, Lord, let thy servant depart in peace. And with that, I introduce Marie Lee, who has spent a lot of hours ministering to the terminally ill. And in one special case, which you probably relayed to you, has great concern for this. She's just come in from Cambridge, Massachusetts. She was working at Harvard at the theological Harvard Divinity School, I mean. And she's sort of the Cicely Saunders of Cambridge. Okay, so that's laying it on you, isn't it?
We had talked about hospice concept, and I am not going to talk to you now about the hospice concept here in America, because it is similar to what Leo has told us about from St. Christopher's. What I want to do is tell you a bit more about my own experience. And I went home from here this morning and wrote this. I am a pilgrim, a human being, a non-professional, medically speaking. I am a mother. I am a woman. I am a Christian. I am a pilgrim. And I am a fortunate person who ventured into a hospice along life's way for refreshment, spent 8 hours one week with one terminally ill man who was 67 years old, had cancer and many other things, and was starving himself to death. He was estranged from his wife. He had four daughters, one of whom visited him occasionally in the hospital. And he offered me the opportunity to care for him and give him enough affection to die. And there was another woman, 85 years old, widow, mother of two sons, estranged from her eldest son, five grandchildren, and two great-grandchildren. The reason I was asked to spend time with her was because she was impossible, and she was. She gave me her life, the knowledge of which and the sharing together has brought me to a new purpose and a new mission in my life. She was a person who had no religion, Jewish background, until she died was still saying that there was no God. But that doesn't mean that God was not able to give me a gift through her. I feel very wealthy. I feel very blessed for this experience. And I have come forth from that hospice with a new awareness, new vitality, a new mission and responsibility. I want to read to you from my master's thesis, a letter that I wrote to this woman, summer of 1980. Jessie, my friend, she is still alive. I meet you as your life is ending, when time is restricted but of little consequence. We have become friends, a bond established at a point in time when new friendships may seem an unlikely happening. Although our friendship will be short-lived, I anticipate this friendship will support the both of us in the time ahead. In response to a request by your family through our hospice, I came into your world with an assignment: to support and assist you as you live your dying, through listening, empathizing, and caring. Your reception of me has enabled me to hear the joys and sorrows of a lifetime as you tell them. I also hear the present fears, anger, pride, resentments, and hopes active in your mind as you do the sorting of unfinished business now at hand. You comment frequently on how much you are learning about life from me, yet I know it is in my accepting of you and your world that you feel this. It is you, Jesse, who is the teacher now. I am learning, however, that in sharing as we do, teaching and learning somehow become synonymous with each other. Now each day as we say goodbye to one another, we know it could be forever. Again, in each meeting, there is new joy and excitement. I sense that through our trust in one another and our honesty with one another, there is a completeness in each parting and each meeting.
Would the guests please go out these double doors on this side, past the snack bar to the volleyball court, and clear the street completely so that if the staff has to get to the hose house, they can do that, or if we can get a vehicle through. Staff, listen for the announcements, please. I'm sure that gave everybody a stretch and you're wide awake now. That was not the plan, but I hope that was the result, that you're ready to resume. I want to say that was probably dust in a smoke detector. The doors at both end of the hall were open and there was considerable dust. So we are closing the doors at the end of the halls. You can help us while the wind is blowing. And I also wanted you to know housekeeping is going through and closing the windows of some rooms. So if someone was in your room between now and supper, it was okay. It was housekeepers keeping your things from being dusty tonight. Marie?
I love you, Jesse. You are my friend. I am grateful for my experience in living shared with you. I take with me enrichment in new energy and motivation as your life touches mine. I look forward to being with you the rest of your life. Your friend, Marie. When I met Jesse in January of 1980, she was expected to live 2 to 4 weeks. She lived 7 months. It was almost as if she put off her dying and got on with some living. She was a very loving person to me, even though she was impossible and remained that way with her family. We shared 6 beautiful months together. Her family could not believe this. After she died, I wrote again. Autumn of 1980. Thoughts to an old friend. It is autumn now, and the leaves are falling. I remember you told me you did not want to see this season again in your lifetime. Leaves on the trees and nature in full bloom were an important part of your world, which you could see through your front window. You are gone. Your life has ended. It was your impending death which brought us together. From the time we met, you somehow managed to live 6 months longer than had been anticipated. Those 6 months were not unlived. I think back to your dying. You did not give up easily throughout your dying, which was in keeping with the manner in which you did your living. I recall our last conversation time together when you reached up to stroke my hair. Shortly thereafter, you asked me if I loved you. to which I responded that I loved you very much. Again, a little later, you asked me if I approved of what the nurses were doing for you in their care of you. I told you I approved. No more words were spoken between us, although several times I saw you open your eyes, focus on me, and gently close them again while I held your hand. Your son stopped by to see you for a while shortly after our last conversation. You knew he was there, although you did not speak. Later that night, you died. Your two requests concerning your dying had been honored, that you be pain-free, that you not be alone. I was beside you when you died, my friend, and you died peacefully. I attended the graveside service in your memory at the time your body was laid to rest. This gravesite was not an unfamiliar place to you. A beautiful place it is. Much of what was said by the rabbi during the service was not understood by me, although two psalms were read and I could follow along. I was touched by the beautiful customs surrounding your Jewish tradition, which I want to remember. You would want to know that all of your family was present, including four of your five grandchildren, their spouses, and caring friends. I was honored to be among them and to be included in the gathering at your son's home following the service. I would also like to tell you that the funeral director of your funeral is now a hospice direct service team member, as am I, because he said of the experience he had had with your family and with me in your home after you died. The friendship we knew together has been honored by your family. They are beautiful people who are as kind and generous as you so often told me they are. I want to stay in contact with them into the future. Your inclusion of me in your dying was a very meaningful experience for me. I am happy I was able to respond to your need of me. We learned much together during those first 7 months of 1980, which will not be forgotten. I am grateful for the deep level of sharing which we established together, too, and I would not be honest now if I did not say I missed this. Your trust in me is a memory which I will cherish. I think of the smallness of your physical stature in contrast to the largeness of your intellectual stature. We did a lot of head work together on occasion, and even when you were tired, you refused to quit, and we talked on. I will always carry a part of you gently within me as I recall the many beautiful thoughts and words you so generously gave to me as gifts.
I was able, through the kindness of your son and daughter-in-law, to spend some quiet hours in the apartment before the furnishings were removed. I thought about you. I thought about us. I am aware that we shared but a moment in your 85 years of life, 800 hours, which was another lifetime for the both of us. You would be happy to know that the black and white sketch of an old man from your living room wall is now on my living room wall. A picture we both liked so much. There is more to be said, my friend, and in time it will be said. From here on in, it is not a time of forgetting, rather a time of remembering. I dedicate this work to you, Jesse. The last thing I want to read briefly is my abstract. The title of my thesis is Dying and Living, a Creative Process. Dying is as important to living is to dying. Because as one dies, so one lives. As one lives, so one dies. This phenomenon we experience around us within the rhythm and season of nature, year after year, where the completion and fulfillment of one season is necessary in the transition to the completion and fulfillment of following seasons, a creative process. In this work, dying is related to seasons of loss and change, autumn and winter, a time when growth of past seasons is shed followed by rest and preparation for a new season. Living is related to seasons of celebration and growth, spring and summer, a time when blooming and new growth are possible because of completed past seasons. Human beings experience seasons of dying and living, shedding, resting, blooming, growing, assisted in process through empathy, compassion, and love of other human beings, and hope of another season. This Master's project is a dying and living, a seasonal cycle within the lifetime of one human being, documented and excerpted in the knowledge that as one dies, so one lives. As one lives, so one dies. Well, I heard Dame Cicely Saunders speak in June, which was an absolute thrill. The woman is very soft looking, very large, like a rock of Gibraltar. She's just the epitome, I think, of what she stands for in the hospice. She speaks very directly. You just know in a moment you could trust her. And she's a very caring person. She was there in the Boston area one day, and she was there to respond to a panel as they brought up different aspects of hospice. And one of the things I noticed that was different from the hospice in England and our concept of hospice, they use volunteers for bereavement work. Whereas here in the States, although we're getting into that, we have used professionals for that in the past and have used volunteers for direct service work, which means, in the case where I was working with Jessie, her family bowed out. They were so happy and relieved to have somebody like me come in. So I was essentially her direct care service person. I mean, I was, in a sense, in charge of her in her home. The hospice that I worked with was Hospice of the Good Shepherd in Newton and Wellesley. And it's 2 years old. We have a base in an old nursing dormitory behind the hospital that exists there in the Newton and Wellesley area, although it has no affiliation with the hospital at all. And from there, we have our administrative offices and our social worker, who is also the person who trains volunteers. We have an oncology nurse, and now we have it's mushrooming. We have people working with art. We have people working with bereavement, with those who are widowed. And we come together there for a support group, which is very important. Our support group meets every other week. And the group that we trained with is the group that we stay with. We get together for 3 hours, 9 to 12 every other Wednesday morning, more if we need it. People who are in our group, we can call any time of the day or night for support if we need it. Oftentimes, especially in situations where people are alone in their own home and they have given all they can possibly give to the patient that they have and come home, they need to be in touch with other people. And so often phone calls are made in the middle of the night, and it's a very, very supportive network that the direct care people have. They are experiencing a need for a hospice facility as such. There are times when patients cannot die at home because they either become ill again and need to have closer medical attention, or plain and simply sometimes because the family is so insistent that they're not going to die that they can't get on with the dying that they're about and they need to get away. So even though they do not want to construct a building for this purpose, they're hoping that some of the rooms in this old dormitory building can be used for housing the hospice patients at this point. Does anybody have any questions about what I'm talking about? We have absolutely no problem at all in getting volunteers to work with the people who are in the hospice.